On this episode of Everything is Fantastic, we're going to look at a Jason Alexander sitcom from the 90s. No, not that one. The animated one. Duckman.
Everything is fantastic.
Hello and welcome once again to another episode of Everything is Fantastic. And continuing with, as I established on last episode, the hastily thrown together theme of new beginnings as a school year begins, we're going to look at the first episode of the cult classic 90s series from USA Network, Duckman, starring Jason Alexander as the voice of the lead character. Basic premise, Duckman is a show about, a duck named Duckman, who is a rather unsuccessful detective whose family really doesn't care that much for him. But damn it, he still tries. So, let's get into it. Duckman, Episode 1, the pilot episode, entitled I, Duckman. The episode starts with a title sequence, which briefly introduces us to the main characters. The episode itself starts with a star-filled night sky. A shooting star passes across. The camera then pans back to show that this is not the night sky, but rather the pupil of a blonde nurse's eyeball. She is running through a hallway, screaming, pursued by some unseen villain. She seals herself behind a door and picks up a phone, still screaming. Her scream travels across the phone lines to a police station where an officer picks up the phone and upon hearing the scream decides that the job is too much for them to handle. He pushes a button marked emergency and lights the Duckman signal, a spotlight in the sky that functions very much like the bat signal. We cut to our hero, Duckman, sitting in an armchair wearing a smoke jacket reading The Quotable Duckman, Witty Bon Mots, Volume 9. He seems rather pleased with himself as he reads, but upon seeing the Duckman signal outside his window, he springs into action. Duckman leaps out the window and lands in the Duckman Mobile, a car that very greatly resembles his face. He's in pursuit of another car, which is holding the nurse captive. He corners the villain in the alley, and after firing off another witty one-liner, slowly makes his approach. The black-cloaked villain has the blonde in chokehold and says to Duckman, "Stay back, or I'll pull back this curtain!" Upon saying that, the mysterious man throws off his black cloak to reveal that he's a game show host, and the woman is his lovely assistant. A curtain is pulled back, revealing a stage with a throne and a sign that reads, "This could be your life." The host welcomes us, saying it's the show that takes someone so important and so one of a kind and shows us what makes them the way they are so that we'll prefer to stay at home and watch them on TV instead of going out and having a life. This week's guest is that incomparable crime fighter, Duckman. The crowd chants his name, and Duckman sits on the throne, smiling as various bras rain down on him, having been thrown from the crowd. Suddenly, we see Duckman's family lean in and whisper something to the host. The host says that Duckman's family has informed him that he is not an incomparable crime-fighting hero, he's not special or unique, and in fact, there's nothing memorable about him at all. A lever is pulled, and a hole opens below Duckman, and we see him fall into a black void. It then fades to Duckman waking up from this dream, screaming, and starts yelling about smoke. Or rather, that he needs a smoke. He reaches for a pack of cigarettes only to find a mousetrap inside with the message, "You're quitting, remember?" written on it. He tosses the mousetrap aside and retrieves an ashtray from under his bed, licking it clean of the cigarette butts that were on it. Our hero, ladies and gentlemen. Cut to the kitchen where we see Bernice, Duckman's sister-in-law, working out as she makes breakfast. Duckman walks into the kitchen, seeming shaken. Bernice speaks up, asking what's wrong and saying, "You can tell me anything." Duckman says he had that dream again where nothing he says or does seems to matter to anyone. Bernice then tells Duckman to shut up because she's on the phone. After ending her phone call, Bernice scolds Duckman for leaving feathers on the sink last night, not taking his dog to the vet to be neutered, and rounds it off by yelling at him for smoking because she can smell it on his breath. Duckman tells Bernice he was not smoking and that she can't accuse him for something he hasn't done. Bernice then accuses him of sucking on the bottom of an ashtray like some disgusting nicotine junkie. Duckman simply replies, "That's better." Bernice tells Duckman she doesn't want the house to smell like one of his stale cigarette butts any longer. At that moment, Bernice's mother, hereafter known as Grandmama, farts. Duckman mumbles he doesn't think it's his stale butt that's causing the problem, and Bernice says that Grandmama can't help it. She's comatose, and then threatens to put Duckman into a coma if he touches the breakfast she made for his kids. Duckman mumbles about making his own breakfast and struggles to find something tasty in the fridge. just because some pasty, wimpy scientist got us all worked up over a few carcinogens. Ajax, Duckman's oldest son, walks into the kitchen and helps himself to the yeast cakes Bernice made and promptly begins choking. Bernice gives Ajax the Heimlich maneuver and he calls off Bernice's stopwatch. Okay. Next, Charles and Mambo enter the kitchen. They are twin brothers. To be more precise, conjoined twin brothers. They have separate heads and necks, but share the same body. They're also geniuses and start the day by arguing philosophy. Duckman tells them to stop, but gets no response. When Bernice tells them not to argue in front of Grandmama, however, they instantly stop what they're doing and head to the breakfast table. This is the last straw. Duckman says he may as well be invisible for the response he gets at home. He gives us an expositional speech about how he understands that when his wife died, she left the house and everything to her sister, but he's still the man of the house and demands to be heard. As he's saying this, Duckman begins to very slowly fade into invisibility. He finally fades out before he can finish his thought, and the scene is punctuated by Grandmama farting again. We cut to a close-up of Duckman's license plate, which reads PSSDOFF. No points for figuring out what that means. Duckman drives to work, musing as to why his life is the way it is. I break for animals, if they're big enough to dent my car. I don't pop any zits above the eyeline. I treat people the way I'd like to be treated. Saying this, he quickly cuts in and steals a parking spot from another car that was getting ready to back into it. The other motorist angrily honks their horn at him, and he yells, "Same to you, sister!" They devote a lifetime to the church, and they think they own the road. So, in case you missed that, Duckman did indeed just steal a parking space from a nun. As he walks to work, Duckman says that he just once wishes he could get the attentions he deserves. Just then, a bird sitting on the telephone wire above him takes a crap on him. Somehow, I don't think that's what Duckman meant. Duckman arrives at his office and we get the first utterance of one of his many catchphrases, "What the hell are you staring at?" We see this is directed at his two secretaries, Fluffy and Uranus, a pair of pink and blue teddy bears, respectively. They are sickeningly sweet characters, addressing their boss as Mr. Duckman. They present Duckman with a bran muffin and a cup of steaming liquid grit to help with his fiber problem. They also tell Duckman they called his doctors, saying that they think that he was smoking again, and so they set traps in all his cigarette packs to try and encourage him to quit. Duckman is less than impressed and kicks Fluffy out of an open window into traffic. Uranus tells Duckman not to worry about Fluffy because the good thing about being stuffed is that they're resilient. Duckman launches Uranus into the air by stomping on the floorboard and then smacks him across the room with a tennis racket. Uranus's head is impaled on a coat rack, but he doesn't seem to be bothered, saying, "That Mr. Duckman, he's getting better at expressing his emotions." Duckman stomps into his office, saying he doesn't care if they work for free. The last thing he needs this morning is to have to deal with a couple of touchy-feely secretaries. His partner, Corn-Fed Pig, says nothing. Duckman walks over to Corn-Fed Zest and sarcastically asks how he's doing. "Aces, Duckman," Corn-Fed replies. Duckman continues to rant about how he feels invisible and unappreciated because there's nothing special or unique about him. "I'm just one more duck detective who works with a pig and lives with the twin sister of his dead wife, three sons on two bodies, and a comatose mother-in-law who's got so much gas she's a fire hazard." Cornfed tells Duckman that there are things that stand out about him, and Duckman tells Cornfed to name one thing that stands out that he'll be remembered for. Cornfed blinks in response, then looks out the window and asks if there's a zeppelin in the sky. Duckman isn't pleased. He's not unique. He's not special. He doesn't even have a coffee mug with his name on it. And we see this is true as his coffee mug reads, "Whoever." Cornfed tells Duckman that it's the dream and Duckman is letting it win. Cornfed knows all about recurring dreams. In fact, let's have him tell us about his.
"I dream I fell and hit my head on a fishbowl, hurt myself just bad enough to work graveyard shift at a convenience store. A group of Hare Krishnas always came in at 4 a.m. and bought 16 gallons of Mr. Slushy and a package of banana-flavored ding-dongs. Then the Swedish bikini team jumped out of a magazine and read Moby Dick to me inside a giant carton of cottage cheese. Why, I'd ask myself, what could it mean? Am I mad? Or is the world simply a mystery too complex to understand?"
As Duckman tries to steer the conversation back to him and his issues, they get a page on the intercom. Fluffy and Uranus says that a package has arrived for Mr. Duckman, but they were going to send it back because it's wrapped in non-biodegradable plastic tape. Duckman tells them to open it. It's probably nothing important because no one cares if he lives or dies. Just then, there's a huge explosion! After the smoke clears, Cornford pops off a drawer in a filing cabinet and says, "Good news. Someone cares." Duckman is ecstatic that someone sent him a bomb, but can't think of who would do it, trying to think if he has any enemies. Cornford can think of a few. Your paper boy, the neighbor whose dog you set bear traps for, the cab driver's union, the father of that ballerina who, and Duckman cuts him off at that point and says he has an idea of who it could be. Duckman and Cornford head off as Cornford suggests a few more potential suspects. Two of Duckman's uncles and Scout Troop 44. Fluffy and Uranus were blown to pieces in the explosion, and Fluffy's head calls out to Duckman, asking if he could find their arms and legs because the radiator his head is currently sitting on is getting very warm. Fluffy's head then bursts into flames and we get an act break. Back from break and we get an establishing shot of a maximum security prison. The sign outside reads 12 days since our last riot. As Duckman is being frisked by a guard, the warden asks why Duckman is so sure that it's this prisoner that Duckman has come to see that is trying to kill him. Duckman says it's because he's a detective and they make a living off their hunches. He was able to narrow it down by process of elimination because this prisoner was the only one in custody since all the others he captured were let off on technicalities. Cornfest says it was because they were found not guilty, and Duckman asks the warden if they can just get on with it. As they pass through his cell block, Duckman says it's a good thing the prisoners are behind bars because he'd love to teach those bread-and-water-swilling brain-dead morons a lesson. Just then all the doors slide open and a horde of prisoners surround Duckman. The warden mentions that they're on the honor system at this prison. Duckman tells the prisoners that he was joking and that some of his best friends are bread-and-water-swilling brain-dead morons. This seems to placate the prisoners, and they leave Duckman alone. Walking through the prison yard, Duckman asks the warden what makes a man spend every waking moment of his life in such a hellhole. The warden replies, "Good dental plan," and then realizes Duckman was talking about the prisoners, and places the blame on too many violent cartoons when they were kids. The warden tells Duckman they attempt to acclimate the prisoners not just back into society, but into high society, as we see some convicts playing instruments and sipping tea delicately. The warden says that there are some who are too far gone, though, and points out a group of white-collar criminals wearing dress clothes and ties working out. A group of insider traders and savings and loan officers are arguing. The warden warns it's a tricky situation and one wrong step could trigger a full-blown riot. Duckman trips over a barbell that's on the ground and knocks into the crowd, triggering a riot. We see the sign outside no longer has a number indicating how many days have passed since the last riot. Finally, Duckman and the warden and Cornfed arrive at the cell of Wolfgang the Cannibal Cracker. The warden mentions how Cracker had committed some of the most heinous crimes known to man, but Duckman doesn't care, saying he caught him once, he's ready for whatever he's got now. Just then, Wolfgang bursts through a hatch in the top of the drawer, terrifying Duckman, who leaps into the warden's arms. Cracker then opens a small adjacent door and apologizes, saying people have come to expect that reaction from him, and invites Duckman, Cornfed, and the warden into his cell. The cell is a rather spacious place with advisors all around telling Cracker about his upcoming appointments and promotional appearances. Cracker says that it's amazing what a horrendous crime the good agent can do. "I don't believe we've met," and Duckman says, "You know who I am. I'm the one who put you away." Cracker replies, "Ah yes, Darkman, Darkwing, Daffy." Duckman corrects him and Cracker remembers. "Ah yes, the one I tripped over." Duckman says they don't have to go into details into that right now. So Cornfed hopefully fills in the blanks, telling the warden that Duckman was running from his sister-in-law, who was chasing him with a waffle iron, causing Duckman to slip on his son's skateboard, which sent him into the path of Cracker, who was making his escape at that time. Cracker tripped over Duckman and ended up flying into the open window of a passing police car. Duckman is convinced that Cracker is now seeking revenge and trying to kill him. On the contrary, getting caught was the greatest thing to ever happen to Cracker. He's become rich and famous since being in prison, wrote a best-selling book that was at the top of the list for 35 weeks, and has managed to erase some of the stigma that was associated with cannibalism. In short, Cracker has no reason to want to kill Duckman, because while Cracker will be rich and adored while in prison, Duckman will languish and die in obscurity, so why bother? A delivery man brings a package for Cracker, and he assumes it's a gift from a fan and excuses himself. Duckman doesn't believe Cracker's story and is convinced that Cracker is the only person to be trying to kill him. An explosion goes off from inside Cracker's room. We see Duckman, a bit mangled in the aftermath, emerge from behind a door and admits that he could now be convinced otherwise. We cut to Duckman and Cornfed driving. Duckman is feeling ill at ease and reaches for his glove compartment for a cigarette, only to find another mousetrap. Duckman is convinced that this bomber will be the death of him, finding him at the office, at the prison, and even in his car as Cornford picks up another package. Duckman panics and throws it out the window, where it lands in the bed of a passing pickup truck. Duckman says he's glad that no one got hurt this time. As he says this, the truck pulls into a convention center where the sign reads, "Welcome, every important world leader." And then the bomb goes off, presumably killing every important world leader. Duckman and Cornford arrive at Duckman's house. Duckman says he wants to try and spend some quality time with his kids just in case anything happens to him. Just then, his sons walk out of the house and walk right by him as Duckman tries to get their attention. Bernice follows, saying since Duckman was 3 minutes late for dinner, she gave it to some guy who came by selling blenders, and there was a message for him about how he made a mistake in his past, and now he's going to pay for it by being blown into 1,000 pieces. Bernice and the kids drive off, and Duckman is left behind, worried about his fate. And we get our second act break. Back from break, and we're back at Duckman's house. Duckman and Cornfed enter the attic. Duckman thinks the clue that they're looking for will be up here, since his entire past is in the attic. Cornfed poignantly says that it's ironic that in searching through Duckman's past to learn who the bomber is, Duckman may also learn who he really is, proving that life is the greatest search of all, man's search for himself. Duckman merely replies that Cornfed has a hunk of broccoli stuck in his teeth. After doing some more searching, Duckman says that he thinks he's found where the answer will lie, in film reels of home movies! Cornfed then decides he's put off rewriting his bathroom tiles for far too long. We get to Cornfed bound via the Ludovico technique and Duckman standing by a projector. The movies are all parodies of other cartoons. We see a Steamboat Willie parody, a Popeye parody, and a Yogi Bear parody, all spotlighting Duckman just generally being a dick to others around him and making poor life choices. Time passes as the stack of watched reels gets higher and higher. Cornfed has grown stubble during the ensuing time. The last film reel is a parody of the animation style of Simpsons, and we see Duckman with his wife, Bernice. Duckman recalls that tomorrow would have been their wedding anniversary and admits that he must have blocked it out since this would be the first year he'd be spending it alone. Cornfed suggests this may explain why Duckman's been feeling the way he has recently. Just then another package flies in through the roof. There's no explosion, so Duckman figures it's a dud. There's a note on the package. It reads, "I'll see you at your grave." Sinister laughter comes from outside, and Duckman sees a shadowy figure in the distance. Cornfed says it's time for the obligatory chase, and the chase ensues. It's a very short chase, as the cemetery is literally right next door. The killer is dressed in very bright colors, and Duckman asks why doesn't he just shoot off a signal flare. Just then, a signal flare shoots up into the sky. Duckman sarcastically replies, "What? No map?" And Cornfed points to a map that helpfully shows the path from the entrance to the Mad Bomber. Duckman and Cornfed enter the cemetery. They chase the Mad Bomber, who very helpfully is wearing a t-shirt that reads Mad Bomber, over some hills. Cresting one hill, Duckman loses his balance and falls into an open grave. It's his grave, which is right next to his wife. He sees a headstone. "Here lies Duckman. Rest in pieces." "Oh, because you're gonna blow me up. Did I ever tell you how much I enjoy your sense of irony?" The Mad Bomber then tells Duckman he's not gonna blow him up. He's gonna chop him up and pulls out a chainsaw. The killer approaches, but loses his footing and control of the chainsaw. Duckman catches the chainsaw and confronts the bomber. "You mess with tigers, you get covered in yellow hair." Not really that intimidating of a one-liner. The bomber apologizes and says that he had to get back at Duckman somehow for taking pictures of him having an affair. The bomber knows that his wife paid Duckman to do it and that she left him afterwards. The bomber says that his wife was the only thing that made him feel like he was special, and now that she's left, it's like he never even existed. Hearing this, Duckman comes to a realization. "You're saying I got paid? I swear I'd remember that." The Mad Bomber takes a closer look and realizes that Duckman wasn't the detective he was looking for. He just looks a whole lot like him. In fact, he looks like any of the other million of duck detectives out there, since there's nothing that distinguishes him from the others. The Mad Bomber apologizes for his mistake, and Duckman reluctantly accepts, saying that these things happen. Duckman tells the bomber he's a little too depressed to take him down to the police station, and will he mind turning himself in? The bomber says he will and walks off, saying that he feels stupid for his mistake. Duckman laments to Cornfield that he's not special. "Even my own murderer doesn't think so." He's just like the bomber. When he lost his wife, he lost his identity. Cornfield tells Duckman that he has something the bomber doesn't have. His children. Duckman is the only father that they'll ever have, and that makes him special. No one else could have created the family you did. Duckman glares at him, but Cornford clarifies he meant it in a good way. Duckman says it doesn't matter since Beatrice didn't think he was capable of raising the kids since she willed custody of them to Bernice. Duckman says that without Beatrice, he's just not a very good father. The night passes and Duckman walks home the next morning. He's about to walk in the door but stops and turns around, walking away from the porch and in front of a dead-end sign near the train tracks. Just then, Charles, Mambo, and Ajax come out of the house. Ajax is carrying a large submarine sandwich and walks over to where Duckman is. He wishes his dad a happy anniversary and says he knows it's tough since this is the first one without Mom, but he and the twins think he's doing a great job and they love him. Ajax splits his sandwich in half and gives part of it to Duckman. He's about to walk away but turns around and gives Duckman the other half of the sandwich as well before finally walking away. We then pan up and get the same night sky and shooting star we saw at the beginning of the episode, and we hear Duckman say, "Thank you, son," as the episode ends. So there you have it, the first episode of Duckman. Like many times with pilot episodes, it was quite different from how the show pans out to be in the long run. Duckman's sons weren't fully defined as characters just yet. We did get some inkling of the fact that, you know, Charles and Mambo were both geniuses, and as the show progresses, we learn that Ajax is very, very, very dumb. We didn't see a whole lot of that in this episode, but believe me, that character trait comes to prominence as the series continues. I've always enjoyed Duckman. I thought it was a very, very underrated series. Not enough people seem to give it the attention and appreciation it deserves. I don't know if it's the fact that for most of its life cycle, it was shown late at night on the USA Network, usually on Saturdays. But I remember after its initial run, it did go syndicated over on Comedy Central, and I remember, you know, catching quite a few episodes on there. But I do remember watching it during its initial run on USA, and it is available on DVD. There's two different packs. Pack 1 is Season 1 and Season 2, and the second pack is Season 3 and Season 4. I picked my copies up on Amazon, and needless to say, good investment in my opinion. And I'm sure if you search around YouTube, you can probably find clips and maybe even whole episodes on there. So if you're at all interested in anything you've heard me talk about on here, or basically just any kind of animated show from the 90s or any era that's trades in usually dark and surreal humor, Duckman is definitely worth a look. Okay, that will do it for this episode. Thank you again for listening. Questions, comments, feedback, and so forth can be sent to chrismcg1983@gmail.com. That's chrismcg1983@gmail.com. Please consider becoming a patron of my podcast over on my Patreon page. That's patreon.com/dramaguycjm, patreon.com/dramaguycjm. And for becoming a patron, for contributing as little as $1 per podcast episode, I will gladly acknowledge and thank you by name at the end of every podcast episode I do, and we've reached that point. So once again, thank you to my patrons, Rachel Delecta and Eddie Landis. Support is much appreciated. Alright, so that's going to do it for this episode of Everything is Fantastic. Next episode of Everything is Fantastic, we'll be looking at the first episode of another animated sitcom from the 90s, The Critic, starring John Lovitz. Also, coming soon at some point, new episodes of This Is Gonna Suck and Witty Banter. As always, keep an eye out on Facebook and Twitter for links for when these episodes are up. Thank you again for listening, and have a good rest of the week.